James chapter 3 verses 1 through 18. The seventh talk in a series on the book of James was presented by Rusty Rexius on January 22, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2017. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going through the book of James, written, I am convinced, by James, the brother of Jesus, written somewhere between 40 and 60 AD. I don't think it matters a lot when, necessarily. I think this is a compilation of sermons that James gave in the synagogue, in the church in Jerusalem, where he was the leader of the church in Jerusalem. And he is speaking specifically to his, I don't know what Jewish synagoguers call themselves, parishioners or whatever, but whatever they are, he's speaking to them. And he's speaking into a particular situation or situations, but he's doing so in the tradition of Jewish teaching, and that is he is speaking from his thoughts on a particular section of the Old Testament. I think that section is Leviticus 19. That doesn't have a great deal of impact on what I just think it's worth noting that, and those of you who don't know this, that's how the Jewish people roll in their teaching all over the world to this day, back then and to this day. They go through the Torah, I think in a year's time, if I remember right, yes, in a year's time, and everywhere in the world, each and every synagogue is speaking or reading the same Torah portion for their synagogue. I don't know if we know this for absolutely sure, but I'm told by folks who I think do know that the way that happened, the Torah portion was read, then a targum, which is an Aramaic explanation of that Jewish reading, was given, and then the rabbi would give his thoughts on that Torah portion. I think those thoughts were a lot like a sermon. In other words, so I've just read Leviticus 19, why does that matter? How does that wash with your life and how you live? And then throughout the week, it's my understanding that they would go back into the synagogue where it would not surprise me to find James or the rabbi speaking to that very same question or series of questions again. So what I think is that James has been doing this for some time. His disciples are recording that. We record with this thing. They would have recorded with some sort of parchment. And at some point, James decides, or his disciples decide along the way, that it's worthwhile to send a copy of this compilation of his sermons to the rest of the Jews in the diaspora, those Jews that were spread out all over the known world, in order to help them in circumstances that were very similar to the ones that they may well have been experiencing in Jerusalem. That compilation is called a Yalkut or a Yalkut. Still not sure how to say it, which is what I think James is. If it's not, it probably doesn't matter. It wouldn't change what he says and it wouldn't change what he means, but that's what I think this is. Written by James, leader of the Jerusalem church, brother of Jesus, to his own folks in Jerusalem, ultimately to any believing Jew in the region. If I were going to say you're all basketball players, and some of you are, and I wanted to instruct you on how to play basketball, I'm going to give you the scoop on how to be a great basketball player, there'd be a long series of things that I would tell you. But after that initial, I'm going to tell you how to be a great basketball player, the things that I would say to you about that would probably apply to any athlete. You wouldn't have to be a basketball player. You could be any athlete. And the things that you would probably do to be a really good basketball player, you would do in anything, any endeavor athletically that you happen to be participating in. And I would go on for a while, and I'd tell you about training and nutrition and agility and quickness and all of those things that obviously matter to a basketball player, but they matter to everybody. And then after a while, I'd probably get to the end of that, and I'd focus back in on, okay, and now I'm going to go back and talk to you a little bit more about specifically how this applies to basketball. And I might give you some very specific things that are more relevant, not utterly irrelevant to the rest of the athletes, but more relevant to the basketball player. So in the end, with my manual that I had written for you as a basketball player, or anybody else, you could read it. And if you were a basketball player, you'd say, well, I mean, I'm just assuming, you would say, that's really helpful. I understand how to be a better basketball player. But if you were anybody else, any other athlete, you'd read that same manual, and I'm suggesting that'd still be helpful. You'd know a lot about how to do whatever it is you do, not basketball, but it would still be applicable and it would still matter. I bet you're not surprised to learn that I think that's a little bit what's going on here in this section in James. That'll maybe make a little more sense in a minute. I'm going to read it. It's a long section. I will let you know that the way this will go, it will seem like there's no way I'll ever get to the end of this, but I promise I will pick up the pace, and by the time you're done, we will have gotten through all of this. And so don't fret that this is 18 verses. James 3, verses 1 through 18. This is my own translation. It's not very different, and so follow along in your New American Standard, probably, or whatever. You won't have a problem. Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, knowing that we will receive a greater judgment. For we all trip up a great deal. If someone does not trip up in word, he is fully matured or a completed man, strong to hold in check the entire body. Now if we place the bits into the mouths of horses to be persuaded by us, indeed the whole body is directed by us. Consider also the great ships having been driven about by strong winds. It is guided by a small rudder wherever the pilot's inclination desires. So it follows also that the tongue is small, or a small part, yet boasts large. Consider a small flame that kindles a great fire. Indeed, the tongue is a fire, a world of wickedness. As follows, the tongue becomes the controller of the rest of our members, defiling our entire body and setting on fire the course of our existence. Indeed, it is being set on fire by hell. For every kind of wild beasts and birds, reptiles and things of the sea are tamed and has been subdued by man. But no one is able to tame the tongue of men. It is restless, evil, and full of poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse men, having been made according to the likeness of God. Out of the same mouth comes a blessing and a curse. It ought not be this way, my brothers. Does a spring produce from the same opening bitter and sweet? My brothers, a fig tree is not able to make olive or a vine a fig, neither salty water to make sweet. Who is wise among you? From good behavior or a manner of life, he should show his works by humility of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfishness or selfish ambition in your heart, do not boast and lie against the truth. This is not wisdom, having been come down from above, but rather is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition are, there is also turmoil in all evil practices. But wisdom from above is first, on the one hand pure, then peaceable, yielding, willing to give in, full of mercy and good fruit, unwavering without hypocrisy. So then the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace among all those making peace. I've gone a little back and forth, quite honestly, about what exactly I think James is doing here. I don't know that I've landed for positive. Maybe in an hour I will have landed. This could be specifically and only for teachers, and probably at one level it is only and specifically for teachers. But like I had in my basketball analogy, even if it is specifically and only for teachers, what comes in the bulk of this section is utterly relevant for all of us, this role of the tongue in our lives. So while you're sitting there listening, you can help me decide whether any of this is inapplicable to non-teachers and what may only be applicable to teachers. But I think, again, I'm speculating a little, but I think James is talking about something that he sees within his community amongst teachers. But then he launches into this reality of the tongue. It doesn't matter who you are or what you do, it applies. And then he comes back and he reminds himself and his listeners or his readers about this role of teaching and the part that the tongue plays in that. By all accounts, you could argue this is a new section in James, and at some level it is, but I do notice that when we get down to 13, this notion of works comes back into the front, which is exactly what we've just been talking about. So new sections, sort of, but not utterly irrelevant to what we've already been talking about, which gives me a little bit of hope about this book of James, which normally is considered just this sort of throw at the board and see what sticks truths that may or may not be applicable to a particular situation. Just here's what I think and here's what you ought to know. I think this is actually a letter or a compilation of letters with a flow. And part of that flow is here, where I think he's thinking back to a little bit of what he's just said, although he has brought on or brought in a new subject. And if I'm right about the last section, if you weren't here, well, you'll get a little bit of it later on, but the one that was about faith and works, if that's primarily being about the fact that genuine believers are those who actually live their lives by the implication of what they say they believe, and that is primarily with respect to Jesus, then I don't have any doubt at all that James, in this teaching, in the synagogue, is taking that reality right to the specifics about what people say, especially teachers. And as I mentioned, I think already, I'm inclined to think that there was some sort of issue within the Messianic community. And I got to thinking, I assume you all know what I mean by Messianic community. But if not, I'll tell you. What that means is that within the Jewish world, there was an expectation of a Messiah. That's probably not a surprise to any of you. I don't know, universally expected Messiah, almost universally, maybe universally expected Messiah. And when Jesus arrives, of course, he is the Messiah that many believe to be, the long-awaited one. And it is those people that have embraced Jesus as their Messiah, those Jewish people, that would be identified as the Messianic community. That was true then, which this just dawned on me just a couple of months ago. Hey, we have Messianic Jews now, and there were Messianic Jews 2,000 years ago. That was the folks that we're actually reading about. So within that Messianic community, that Jesus-believing Jewish community, I think that James is talking specifically about within that community what teachers might say. And it seems to me that, I mean, we don't know what the issue is for sure, but what comes later in this passage makes me think that there was something going on where people were vying for a role as a teacher. There was some sort of, competition's the right word, but a sense in which people were tugging of war about who was going to be the teacher in the community. And I don't have a great deal of evidence that this is the case. That just seems like that might be what's going on here. One of the thoughts that I had about that, as I was trying to place myself in that community, wondering what was going on, why was James saying this, what was being said at the time, I do wonder if it's true that these believing Jews were being ostracized, sort of set aside by the mainstream Jewish culture, respect and lore was hard to come by. They were looked down upon, teased, ridiculed, ostracized, alienated. But one way one might get some respect within a community is in the role of a teacher, at least maybe they could get some respect as the role of a teacher. So I wonder if that's a little bit what was going on. A way to sort of give oneself, redeems oneself in the mind, at least of those around them and in the eyes of those around them. Again, I don't know if that's the case, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was. Ultimately, what he is about to say, although directed at a situation for sure, is absolutely relevant to everyone. I don't have any doubt about that. It's relevant to anyone and it's relevant to everyone. But his launching point is teachers. something was going on. So a few thoughts before I get into the actual passage about teachers. In many respects, this is an incredibly uncomfortable passage. I know Ron's taught on it. I don't know if anybody else has before. But I'm a little bit puzzled about what even to say. So I'm going to launch in and share a little bit of just my own thought process about this notion of being a teacher. There's a part of me, as I read this section, that just thinks to myself, just shut up and sit down. What in the world do you have to say? And I think if you're a teacher or some sort of a teacher, at some point you've probably thought that. If you haven't, well, I don't know what to say about that, but you've probably thought that. And at some point, and in some ways, I think there could be some real wisdom in that. Sometimes you should shut up and sit down. You don't always have to have something to say, which goes against my grain, and my family who is here knows that. But that would probably be a good exercise from time to time. But then some are teachers. They just are. Not many, as James seems to note by his instructions, but some are. Some are just teachers. And they should teach. That's what they should do, for they are teachers. James is going to go on in a moment and discuss the danger of the primary tool of the teacher, that's the tongue, which, as I said early, becomes extraordinarily valuable, a valuable lesson to all of us, not just teachers. But as I was studying this and I was thinking about it all week, I found myself asking, so who's a teacher? Who should teach? And I don't pretend to have all the answers here, and I am not suggesting for a minute that necessarily anyone and everyone who has ever stood here, including me today, qualifies. I would say everyone who stood here previous to me does. I'll leave it at that. But there are three things or three criteria that I thought of that qualify somebody to teach. Here's what I came up with. Number one, they're gifted in study. There is a skill set, I think both born and learned, that allows one to take on a difficult text like the Bible, language and all, and make sense of it. And what I mean by make sense of it is get at the very center of whatever it was that the author intended to say. Of course, there's this ginormous question hanging, how do you know when you've nailed what the author has intended? But the teacher, I think, can. And the teacher, I think, will, eventually. There's weeks and weeks and weeks of things to say about that process, but you've all been around here long enough. I think you know exactly what I mean by that. If not, then you can go get a copy of a book that I know about, written by three people in the, all three people in the audience, The Language of God. It talks about that process. Number two, I think a teacher is gifted in communication. And I don't mean that they're necessarily eloquent of speech, although that can be super helpful, but they can take what can be a difficult and foreign and complex and deep and even troubling idea and concepts and put them into terms that make sense. It makes sense to those that they're communicating to. Of course, there is this question of whether or not those that are listening have eyes to see and ears to hear. But I think anyone who is standing in the role of a teacher, as such, has been able to communicate what it is they are trying to teach. They know how to communicate. I've listened to brilliant people try and communicate what they have learned or discovered and found it virtually unlistenable. I think I just made up that word. And while they may be gifted in study and learning, they cannot and they do not have the ability to pass that along. I would contend that they are not teachers. Number three, and maybe most importantly, their lives shadow what they teach. And of course, this is incredibly tricky. Not one of us, teacher or not, ever lives their lives completely in the light of what we say we believe. It's just a given. And I think we all understand, and we're all sympathetic to that. But there are those who, in practice of their lives, really do endeavor to walk what they talk. It is, in effect, just how they live their lives. And as they live, the question never leaves them, what do I do in light of what I'm saying? Maybe the best way to highlight this is the opposite. Everyone knows of those who fundamentally do not live in the light of what they say or believe. Such a one cannot and should not teach, at least as I would understand James to say, is a teacher. And I thought of a fourth thing, actually, today as I was quickly going back over all my notes. A teacher takes this stuff seriously, very seriously. Whether 2 or 20 or 200 people that you might have something to say to, this stuff matters, and it matters deeply to the teacher. And it sits deep within you what to say and how to say it and if it's true. Not sure if this is exactly the right way to communicate this, but a teacher is somber about what it is that he might have to say. So I'm not sure those are now the four things, or let me put it this way. I'm not sure that if you have those four things, you're necessarily a teacher, but I am sure that a teacher must have those four things true about them. And in my opinion, this is frightening, or at least it should be, for anyone who thinks of themselves as a teacher. But some are, and some should, and some do. They endeavor to teach the truth in spite of all the reasons why one might question the wisdom of ever doing so. They are teachers because God has made them so. And James says, interestingly, there is a risk, and you should weigh heavily whether or not to call yourself a teacher. And what is that risk, he says, or I say, I ask, greater judgment, which is a very odd concept, and I'm not convinced I have this square yet. But I ask the question, in what way is a teacher subject to greater judgment? First, it seems that James is including himself. Notice he says, we all. So it's not just you all, but we. James is talking about himself. Secondly, I assume the judgment that he's referring to is the judgment of God. It could be the judgment of other people, but I don't think so. I think it's the judgment of God. As teachers, we are using one of the most susceptible things to corruption there is, our tongues, and we're going to see that later. Third, while James does not address this per se, I'm actually and have been thinking back on some of the comments that Jack made from 1 Corinthians at the beginning of his last session, and this notion of building people of gold and silver and precious stones, not wood, hay, and straw. And if I heard him right, you can correct me if I'm wrong, much of that responsibility of building people of gold, silver, and precious stones, much of that responsibility rests on the teacher to commit him or herself to truth and the unrelenting pursuit of that truth. And if I understood the alternative, as teachers, we are using the one thing most susceptible to corruption, our tongues. I said that a minute ago, and it is the tongue that persuades those who will listen otherwise. It is the tongue, for all sorts of reasons, that can and will lead people astray to something other than what is true. It is the tongue that lures people into believing what is false and ultimately to their own demise. It is no wonder to me that James recognizes the great responsibility of the teacher and their tongue. So back to the question about why teachers stand in stricter judgment. And the best that I could do is to come up with this, because the tongue that James will now go on to discuss as the purveyor of great evil, those are my words, while dangerous in every human being, seems to possess the greatest threat in the mouth of a teacher, for it possesses the power to lead people to destruction. And as such, it is those who claim to teach that will be measured more strictly when judged, for it is in teaching that the destiny of others can hang in the balance. So if one fancies himself or herself as a teacher, it seems to me that one should pay extra close attention to what it is that James has to say. That was verse 1. Verse 2, for we all trip up a great deal. If someone does not trip up in word, he is fully matured or completed, or a fully mature and completed man, strong to hold the tongue in check, strong to hold in check the entire body. My translation is actually a little rough, but I think James's point is fairly clear. There is much in our lives that we screw up. There's little doubt about that. In fact, arguably, most of our lives is a screw up. And all that is wrong with us is worthy of our attention and our desire to do it and be it right. But of all the things for us to pay attention to, teacher or otherwise, notice James uses we all. I think he means we all, not just teachers. The thing most powerful to contain in our lives is our tongue. More specifically, if we learn to contain our tongue, that is powerful, very powerful. In fact, James seems to believe that the one who understands the role of the tongue in their life, and he masters that, that goes a long ways to mastering his whole body. And those of you who, like me, have struggled with a loose tongue know exactly what James is talking about here. It is better when you hold your tongue, period. I don't think this is a hypothetical, nor is it an unattainable goal. It is what each of us should strive for. It is, I think, the believer's maturity in action. And then to tie this directly to what I was saying last week, and again, if you weren't here, I apologize, but living by the implications of what I believe, there could be no better example for me of what that looks like, or at least it should. So over and over and over and over and over again in my life, it is what comes out of my mouth that causes the most havoc. I say really, really terrible and hurtful things. Early on in my life, while I'm sure I felt sort of bad for some of the stuff that came out of my mouth, I don't think it ever crossed my mind to think about what it was that I was ready, willing, and able to say, stuff that I knew and could be and would be terribly damaging. I just don't think I gave it a thought. And I know that I never thought through, not early on, what the story of Jesus, who I did call my Lord and Savior, meant with regard to the most of the things that I would ever say. I knew I couldn't curse. I definitely wasn't supposed to take the Lord's name in vain. I wasn't supposed to lie. I shouldn't dishonor my parents. And it would be better if I didn't brag. But to ask the question, what does my faith in Jesus imply in what I might say? Never, never. And this is my beef, my personal beef, with what, at least in my experience, our culture's evangelical Christianity propagates. Come to Jesus and he will make you well. Jesus died for our sins. Accept him. And all those sins will be forgiven. Trust in Jesus, and all that was wrong with you is made right. Sure, some of that is absolutely true. But it wasn't until that I was invited, frankly here, I mean not in this room, but here in this group, to look deeply into what Jesus hanging on that cross really meant, and the whole backstory behind that, that it ever dawned on me. It ever dawned on me to ask the question, so what does all of that stuff say about me? Really say about me and the implications that has in my life. How am I actually going to live with my mouth? And a long, hard look at that, and I'm still looking, has suggested to me something that I am terrified by. Once a rebel, always a rebel. As I mentioned last week, what the history of my faith has taught me is that I am fundamentally at odds with my Creator. As such, I do not stand in his favor. But my Creator has provided me an out for my rebellion. That out is Jesus. Jesus took what I deserve, and by doing so, Jesus will serve as my attorney, my advocate, and my defender when I stand trial before God, my Creator. And why will I need that advocate on that great and final day? Because while I have seen all that Jesus has done and why, I'm still a rebel. I still am at the core of who I am, at odds with my Creator. I want what I want, not what my Creator wants, and that is rebellion. And rebels, left unto themselves, are not blessed. They're cursed. But there is one thing now fundamentally different. One thing utterly changed. I hate that rebellion that's inside of me. I see it for what it is. It's death, and I desperately want something different. I want to be something different. This is, as you know, the work of the Spirit of God. And now, as the Spirit of God works in my life and teaches me what is good and what is right and what is pure, I see things that I have never seen before. And in me, personally, what I see is the venom that is on my tongue. I'm ready to strike and kill, but it no longer is something I am proud of. And I used to be proud of that. No, I'm horrified by what it is, and I want something very, very different. And I should want something very, very different. For that is the implication of what I believe. So now, as I am faced over and over and over again with those same things, those hurtful and damaging things that just naturally roll off my tongue, I ask myself, sometimes out loud, given the implication of what I believe, what should or shouldn't I say? This, it seems to me, is one of the ways in which I am tested as to the genuineness of my faith. That is, to be asked the question and given the opportunity to answer with the action of a believer. If I ever thought a passage was written specifically for me, this is it. Back to my translation for a second in verse 2. For we all trip up a great deal. If someone does not trip up in word, he is fully matured, strong to hold in check his entire body. The way the others' translations render this, I'll read out of New American Standard, for we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. It makes it sound, at least to me, like James is suggesting that perfection, something like righteousness, I think, is the goal. Like actually not having this problem. But I don't think that's what James is saying. The word that gets translated here, perfection, is a word that we've seen before, teleos. Teleos. It can and has meant the final result, or the end game, or the ultimate intention. But it can also mean something like full grown, or mature, or it's been figured out. And that's what I think James has in mind here. Not that the tongue and all that the one who owns it is no longer what it once was, but rather it has come to understand its potential and it has learned to contain and control it. And by doing so, it can and will steer the entire course of the body, which I take to mean what actually happens in a person's life. I think these next passages will bear this out. Verse 3. Now if we place the bits into mouths of horses to be persuaded by us. Indeed, the whole body is directed by us. Simple point, makes a lot of sense. One controls the entire body and being by simply maintaining control over one very small area. This is the follow-up, I think, to the last line in verse 2, strong to hold in check the entire body. Just look at the example of the horse, he says. Once we figure out that a bridle in the mouth of a horse directs everything, then everything is under direction. It works. It's a powerful image, I think. I'm not a horse guy, but I know enough about horses to kind of get that. And I don't think anyone doesn't relate to that. By bidding our mouths, so much of the rest of our body and our life is controlled. How much better might we be if we simply stayed quiet? Again, this is why teaching, in my opinion, can be such a frightful experience. We must so carefully watch what we say, or, as it were, keep the bit in our mouth. Verse 4, consider also the great ships being driven about by strong winds. It is guided by a small rudder whenever the pilot or wherever the pilot's inclination desires. Same exact point, I think. Control the rudder, control the ship. The minute you lose the grip on the wheel, that is the control of the rudder, the entire ship is at risk of crashing. You have absolutely no control. The ship goes wherever the wind blows. So it follows, verse 5, also the tongue is a small part yet boasts large. Consider a small flame that kindles a great fire. The focus here shifts from the size and control of something to more along the lines of the size and damage. From the harnessing of such a small thing to the control of a much larger thing. The focus now is how such a small thing can do such huge, enormous damage. In other words, one should not minimize what can happen when the tongue is left unchecked. The point is fairly simple. The tongue, a very small member of the body, controls how it goes for the rest of the body. Think about this and how much we should consider this during the course of our lives. This is so relevant. If we could do anything at all, wouldn't we want to ask, shouldn't we ask to control our tongues? Again, the imagery is incredibly powerful here, that back to the fire. Only a small, small flame can begin the greatest of fires and the following damage. In fact, it is nearly always only a very small flame, a sort of insignificant spark that builds to a raging and destructive fire. How many times has it been a sort of innocent comment, a little something that just slipped off your tongue that ended up waging a war? This seems especially true in marriage. It is also especially true in parenting. A father or a mother's words, few and small as they can be, can wreck a kid's life. Susie and I have done a good bit of premarital counseling over the years for weddings that we've done. And in that, it always includes a discussion about kids. And while there is a whole lot to say about raising kids, there is no more important subject, I would argue, or passage for that matter, to deal with. Of all the tools we have as parents in the quest for raising our kids, there is no more effective or damaging tool than our tongues. You know how it is that we say in problem solving, your first inclination is probably the right one? Not so with what we think we should say, especially with our kids. The first inclination is probably exactly the wrong thing to say. Stop. Just stop. Think it through. Truly consider the implications. You should probably say something different. As spouses and parents, we would do well, very well, to learn and to care, to harness our tongues. Proverbs 15:28 says, "The heart of the righteous ponders how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours out evil things." Verse 6, "Indeed, the tongue is a fire. The world of the wicked or unrighteousness, the world of the wicked tongue is brought about in our members, defiling the whole body and setting on fire the course of birth and having been set on fire by Gehenna." I have a different translation I think I like better. I'll read that one. "Indeed, the tongue is a fire, the world of wickedness." As follows, the tongue becomes the controller of the rest of our members, defiling our entire body and setting on fire the course of our existence, indeed being set on fire by hell. Fire here is certainly not an endearing term. Fire causes destruction. Fire causes devastation. The world of the wicked, that is the fire, the world of the wicked, or what results from unrighteousness. It is, I think, worth noting that fire can be contained. You can put up protections, and the fire ultimately causes little damage, or at least you can control the damage. Not exactly sure how far to take that analogy, but I think the point here and what follows is that the tongue spreads damage to the rest of the body, just as fire wreaks havoc on its world when left to spread and left uncontained. Ultimately, by suggesting that the tongue is the controller of the rest of our body and it sets fire on the course of our existence, what James seems to be saying, that what comes out of our mouth is the determiner of our life. What we say lays the foundation for everything that follows. And why all this? Why go on and on about this? Because the tongue, James doesn't say this here, others do, and I'm going to, because the tongue is the revealer of the heart. Over time, what we say will always provide the evidence for the condition of our heart. In my experience, I can oftentimes control what I do, but give me enough time, and I simply cannot control what I say. Not always. And lest I ever consider myself good, I am reminded by the truth of my tongue. What does he mean by set on fire by hell? I'm not exactly sure what to make of this, but I assume hell is just supposed to represent evil. So if so, James is just saying that what sets the course of our life to destruction is evil. And that certainly is true. The point, it seems, is to recognize the evil that is laying in wait in my tongue. I must see it. Verse 7, "For every kind of wild beast and birds and reptiles and things of the sea is tamed and has been subdued by man." He continues the point, man has the capability of bringing into his control virtually everything in creation. He has mastered everything around him. In fact, that was given to him by God. Genesis 1:28 says, "And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and every living thing that moves on earth." But it would take the intervention of God, God himself, for man to do the very same thing with his tongue. If we think back on what Eve did, I think we always think of what she did as doing evil. But what she did, in my opinion, is effectively said to God, "Screw you. Screw you." Verse 8, "No one is able to tame the tongue of men. It is restless, evil, and full of poison." The one missing thing in man's control is his tongue. If ever there was a question about the true condition of man's heart, that is, the heart that is left unto itself without any intervention of God, The tongue answers that question, and little is left to wonder. We simply cannot help saying what is inside of us, save the grace and the activity of God. By restless, I think he means it cannot wait to jump out and do some damage. For some reason, I have this image of a bull in a cage right before he goes out for a bull ride. And you've seen that where he's just banging, he's banging, and you open the gate and out he goes like a glass of water being poured out. That's exactly the image I have of my tongue, just waiting to get out of its cage. That's what I think he means by restless. Evil, that's what naturally comes out. It's just not good. I thought about launching on to a little ditty here on the depravity of man, and I won't, but I think this speaks to that. Our tongue is just wrong because our heart is just wrong, and our heart is just wrong because we're depraved individuals. And again, lest there be any question about that, just listen to yourself or listen to me. And full of poison, poised to hurt, poised to damage, and poised to kill. That appears to be what James thinks is the nature of our tongue. So graphic and so relevant and so real. Verse 9. With it, that is our tongue, we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse men. Men having been made according to the likeness of God. I think here is simply pointing out the contradiction in who and what we are. Within seconds, we can be thanking God for all that he has done and praise him for his sovereignty and his goodness, and then turn right around and show a profound lack of mercy towards others. Others who, like us, are the product of God's creation. It is just not hard to see this is exactly the sort of thing that James is talking about. Every one of us has seen it, and every one of us has lived it. Verse 10, he says, out of the mouth comes a blessing and a curse. It ought not be this way, my brothers. The point here, I think, is the same. But it is worth noting that James is very likely, I think, thinking about the many blessings that occur in Judaism. This is where that notion of remembering, we're listening in on a Jewish conversation here. I suspect and have no doubt that he has seen and experienced the reality of in one moment reciting a blessing, one of the many in Judaism, and in the very next moment, curse a neighbor. That's probably happened over and over again in his life, or he's seen it over and over again. And I can just imagine James sitting there, pausing and slumping and sighing and saying, it ought not be that way. It ought not be that way. Verse 11, does a spring produce from the same opening bitter and sweet? The point here, I think, is profound and scary. James points out that a spring, which I think is the mouth, which I think reveals the heart, cannot produce what is both good, that is sweet water, and bad, which is bitter water. It produces one or the other. And then by implication, it seems to me, what James seems to be saying is that the mouth, the indicator of the heart, suggests by what it pours out the condition of our heart. In other words, we know who we are by what we say. That to me is scary. Verse 12, my brothers, a fig tree is not able to make olives, or a vine a fig, neither salty water to make sweet. Same point as above, but the question does arise to me here, so, and maybe with you as well, so can we control our tongues? James and me now have been going on and on about the problem of the tongue, and I've suggested that it's an insurmountable problem. So can we control our tongues? Can we tame the tongue? Whether you're a teacher or simply a creature, can we keep our mouths in check? I think the answer is in 13, which is what we're going to read next. The wise and the skilled are those who limit what they say. Well, how? Who is wise and skilled among you? From good behavior or manner of life, he should show his works by humility of wisdom. This, I think, is going back to James' initial remarks about teachers, instructors in truth. He asks, who among you fancies themselves as teachers, as wise and as skilled? James says, well, I'll tell you who the wise and the skilled ones are. They are the ones who in their manner of life, how they actually live, do so by living out the implications of what they believe with humility of wisdom. What then is humility of wisdom? What's the movie? I Want That. My son knows. I Want Humility of Wisdom. I want that. It seems to me that the wisdom here is knowing the truth about who we are and what we're capable of, and that left unto ourselves, the picture is very, very ugly. Wisdom, at least as I understand it, boils down to rightly assessing any situation and determining the proper course of action. That, I think, is wisdom. And with respect to ourselves, then, rightly assessing the situation leaves one humbled, sober, as to what is true of who they are and what they are really made of. And I think this cannot help in real wisdom but to leave one humbled before their God. And as wisdom rightly assesses that situation of the heart, it recognizes that from the heart can come words of great destruction, whether it's teaching or otherwise. And from that recognition comes the desire to corral what one says out of humility. And that corralling what one says, that I think is his works in humility, that comes from wisdom, ultimately plays out in a good manner of life. Slowly but surely, but increasing over the course of life as we continue to live by the implications of what we believe. And in the context right here, carefully measuring each and everything we say. So yes, we can corral, contain, control our tongues when we recognize what's behind it. That, I think, is what the mature one does, whether you're a teacher or otherwise. Verse 14. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not boast and lie against the truth. Again, I think we're speaking primarily back to teachers here. And I think what James is saying is that if you are a person, by self-assessment, I think, who has bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, this, by the way, is where I get the idea that there's some sort of, I don't know if contest is the right word here, but something going on in their community where such a person may have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, again, maybe as a teacher in your heart, he's saying, basically, shut up. Stop talking. Don't teach. It seems to me that there could be at least two things going on here that James could be saying. One, he could be saying, if these things are true of someone, that is jealousy and selfish ambition, don't pretend it's not so. Don't pretend those things are not true of you. And say to those who are listening that it's not so. In other words, don't lie about what's going on inside of you. The second option, it could be that James is saying that the one who has jealousy and selfish ambition in his heart and is teaching as one who is instructing in the truth, the things that they're saying are simply not true. They're lying, which I don't think is true. I don't think that's actually probably the case. I think it's the former. And again, if these things are true of someone, that is jealousy and selfish ambition, stop pretending or don't pretend that it is not so inside of you, and say to those who are listening that it's not so. Boasting and lying, I think he's speaking about boasting and lying with regard to what's inside of you. Such a person is lying to those listening about what he or she is all about. So I think it's boasting or lying about yourself, not about what you're actually saying. What's tricky here is that somebody who is boasting and lying about themselves may actually be saying true things. So it's hard. You don't always know. But I'm not sure that he's speaking to those of us who are supposed to know. He's speaking to those who are speaking, the teachers. What's true of you should indicate what you should do. I was reminded of the passage here in Philippians where Paul says, some to be sure are preaching Christ, even from envy and strife, but also some from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that that's what doesn't matter. That passage is fascinating because Paul seems to think that there are those who are, I would argue, speaking with bitter jealousy and selfish ambition and still saying true things. And it's not as though those things don't matter. They do matter. They're still true. But James isn't talking about that. He's talking about what's inside of the person speaking and what that person should think about who they are and what they're doing. As I said, I think this section is still directed at teachers. If a teacher recognizes in their role as a teacher that within them and with regard to their teaching, there is bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, then they need to step away from the microphone or whatever they had back then. They ought not boast as though their heart is pure in what they are doing and lie about what is actually going on within them. And what might actually be going on, understanding and communicating what is true is not at the core of what they are doing. Rather, some sort of self-promotion or self-aggrandizement is what is actually in play. In other words, they're not about the truth. They're about themselves. And they should step away from the pulpit. And I suspect you've probably all seen that. Probably not here, but you've probably all seen such an example. And it's never pretty. And that you don't normally see it here, and I'm not speaking about today, I'll leave that aside, but that we don't see that here, we should be extraordinarily grateful. Utterly and extraordinarily grateful. What James seems to be saying is that if, as a teacher, or at least one who wants such a role, senses and sees within him or herself this notion of bitter jealousy of other teachers, I think, or selfish ambition with regard to what one might gain as a teacher, I think, then the humility of wisdom stands down or sits down. This does not mean that such a one is not a believer. It just means that he shouldn't be teaching. Verse 15. This is not wisdom having come down from above, but rather is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. The one who actually does recognize his own motives, that is, understands this jealousy and selfish ambition, and does not, in the humility of wisdom, back away, such an assessment is wrong. It's earthly, it's unspiritual, and it's demonic. That leaves little left to wonder what James thinks about that sort of behavior and what that sort of person should do. For where jealousy and selfish ambition are, there is also turmoil and all evil practices. No surprise here, jealousy and selfish ambition do not turn out well. And again, while it is probably true that anywhere at all, that jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is some degree of turmoil and evil practice. But it seems certain to me, specifically in this case, with this reference to teachers, such things are absolutely the case. Turmoil and evil practices. When you have teachers who are doing so for reasons of jealousy and self-promotion, the entire community suffers. Period. Verse 17. But wisdom from above is first, on the one hand, pure, then peaceable, yielding, willing to give in, full of mercy and good fruit, unwavering and without hypocrisy. I'm not sure, but I think all these things are what wisdom sees about oneself, or rather, after assessing oneself, these are what one strives for to be true of one who is actually wise. One strives to be peaceable, yielding, willing to give in, full of mercy and good fruit, unwavering and without hypocrisy. So this is what one pursues in one's heart. This, I think, is the pursuit of righteousness. And I probably could have spent a lot more time on those words, and there's probably more to say about that, but I didn't. And then last, I told you we would get through it, verse 18. So then the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace among those making peace. And I'm going to be straight up honest here. I'm not sure what to do with this verse. I'm not really sure I understand what he's saying. Verse 16 and 17 contrasted jealousy and selfish ambition with wisdom, which leads to that list of things that I just said. So I assume the fruit of righteousness is exactly what wisdom produces, that same list. Those things that are sown, I assume that he means practiced or engaged or spread by the one striving to make peace as over against turmoil and evil practice, which here probably means this is a teacher, results in peace. Peace among those in the community. That's where I'm not sure what he means by peace here. Is it peace with each other, peace with God? Is it both? I don't know. So back to my original comments, and then I'll open it up if there's anything. I do think that this is a section of Scripture that if you're a teacher, and I think it's absolutely ironic, as I look around, there are a number of teachers in the room, some who are not normally here. I find that interesting. What is he saying to us if we call ourselves teachers? I think he's saying that we take that super, super seriously and humbly and somberly, that it is not a given that just because you think you have something to say means you're a teacher. And as a teacher or anybody else, what we use in that endeavor, our tongue, is of all the things that are out there, the most dangerous of everything. And I think at some level, we just know that. We don't have to live very long at all to know that the tongue does damage that nothing else can do. And we also, if we've lived it all, know how hard it is to contain and control that. As a teacher, there are apparently greater consequences of not being able to do that. But as a human, there are horrible consequences of not paying attention to this. The encouragement here, it seems to me, is that James, in spite of all the terrible things that he says happens, I think he actually believes that you can go a long ways in maturity to controlling the tongue. And in my own life, although what I said is absolutely true, on the tip of my tongue is venom, I have learned that it's there. I know it's there. And I don't know what percentage of the time, doesn't really matter, but that I know it's there helps me do what I think James says in maturity of controlling my tongue. And as one who has learned a little bit of control, it just goes better. And you all have had that experience as well by controlling your tongue as a teacher or as just a human. Great advice for anybody. That's it. Now I dare anybody to say anything.
I have a little question about part at the beginning when you were saying that teachers will be judged more strictly. Does that mean just anyone who formally takes upon the title is teacher, or does that mean anyone who has any influence within church or community of believers? Because I'm pretty sure that there are lots of people who may not teach formally, but probably have influences of directing of the belief of others within the community.
Yeah, that's a great question. I thought about that, actually, not just with respect to judgment, but just generally, who are the teachers here? Both are true. Certainly, we're all teachers at one level of somebody somewhere. There's just no doubt about that. We just are. Here, I think this is the person who's taking on the formal role of a teacher. I think that's who James has in mind. Now, that doesn't mean that what he's saying isn't necessarily true of just everyday teachers. That's not a pejorative term. But I think he's speaking to the people who have a role of a teacher, which makes more sense to me with respect to this notion of judgment. And I don't know that I've got that part right. I would love to hear somebody who has another idea about how that stricter judgment is played out, because my understanding is we're all going to go and stand before the judgment seat of God, and either we're in or we're out based on whether we have an advocate or not. And if I have teacher on my name tag or not, I can't find where the stricter part comes up. So it's something a little different than that. I took a shot at it. But to your question, the official role as a teacher, I think, here. Thank you. That's a good question.
Rusty, being somebody that was in the teaching field for about 30 years, I remember when I first started teaching and I had 200 kids my first day of teaching, and I had 100 parents for those 200 kids. And I remember, I thought, oh my goodness, now I got all this responsibility to teach what I'm supposed to be teaching. And I remember several years later, there was a colleague of mine, a lady, that came up and she says, Ken, she says, why in the world do we take our job so seriously? And I don't think, even though that I taught for a long, long time, you never were able to shed that. You have kids in your class and you had a job that you had to do, whether or not they all agreed that you did it well, was beside the point, but you still could never get away from that fact. And that's just teaching in a school where you're teaching math or science or something else.
Yeah.
You can imagine when you flip-flop it and then try to, or extend it to God's truth, you're talking about an entirely different ballgame, if that makes sense. I just don't think you can be a teacher, really call yourself a teacher, if you don't take your job seriously.
Right. That was my third point or fourth point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
Yeah, and the 2 points couldn't really relate to the third point that you made, but the first 2 points, the one where you have to study.
Yeah.
Because when I first started teaching, I never had any instruction on how to teach a math. That was a long time ago, but you basically didn't. And so you had to take advantage of all the opportunities you had to study and figure things out so that you could communicate what you're trying to do better. And that's a never-ending process.
Right.
But I always felt it took at least 3 years to teach a class before I started feeling comfortable that I got most of the kinks worked out. It doesn't mean that there still weren't kinks, but at least there weren't near as many as the first time around.
The thing that I have found so stressful about the Bible and teaching, I mentioned this, I think, last time, there's no teacher's guide. Like, we'll never know. As a teacher, whether we got it right or not. And as anybody who has ever done this in a way that has caused people to question what you're saying because it's different or beyond the pale or off the beaten path, then you've thought about that and people are listening to you and believing what you're saying. Well, what if you're wrong? It's one thing to be wrong about the Pythagorean theorem. It's a little different to be wrong about the gospel. I get it. God's in charge of all of this. I'm not in his way of whether or not you or anybody else can understand the truth. But as one who's saying things, man, sometimes that's just like, shut up. Just shut up and sit down. But I don't. Here I am. Because Jack made me do it.
Well, ask David something about this on trying, how can you describe God and give him what's due him? How can you even come close to it? And he says that his response was, well, he says, even though that we might not be able to express ourselves adequately, he knows our heart.
Yeah, exactly. So, very good advice.
That helped.
Very good advice. Thank you all.